All right, well, let's begin. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Eric Peterson. I'm the director of the Global Strategy Institute here at CSIS. It gives me special pleasure to welcome you to this event entitled Population Boom or Bomb. It will be a discussion of population trends and current attitudes in the Middle East. We have two wonderful speakers to help contribute to our discussion of this timely issue today, one of whom is caught in the traffic in 66 right now, but I'm reassured that he's making his way in very quickly, John Alterman. The other has graciously agreed to begin, and we're thankful to him for that. But before we start, let me go through one or two housekeeping issues. Would you please turn off any devices that you have which will make noise over the course of the proceedings? Also, we'd like to keep our proceedings today relatively informal, so I hope that you'll feel comfortable in terms of standing up to fill your coffee cup again or to get any of the food that we have in the back of the room. The final point is that I wanted all to know that we are being filmed. We're being recorded today. Our intention is to post excerpts of our discussion here today, possibly on the website or a blog that we're developing for GSI. So with that, by way of background, it now gives me a special pleasure to launch our proceedings. Let's begin by introducing ourselves for our speaker. Could we begin? I'm sorry I've cut you in mid-bite here. Thank you for coming.
This is Travis Elliott. I'm with Mills Brigham on Governance at CSIS.
My name's Joe Bullion. I'm a panelist at Bradley Howard.
My name's Zach Kahn. I'm an intern here at CSIS, and I go to Johns Hopkins to site.
Jeremy Pierce with the Development Program here at CSIS.
Pete Quinn, National Guard Fellow at CSIS.
Laura Keating, I work at the Global Strategy Institute.
Who's also a point player in our large global water initiative, which is focusing in part on Middle East issues.
I'm Andrew Gossett, I also work at the Belcom here at CSIS.
I'm Kathy Morris, I'm
the
leader of the Middle East Programs.
Wonderful. Well, warm welcome to all. We have a very interesting set of issues to take on this morning, and we'd like to begin to approach these issues by introducing our first speaker, Stephen Cull, who's director of the Program on International Policy Attitudes, PIPA, and the Center on Policy Attitudes, COPA, right? Which he is a political psychologist who studies world opinion on a variety of key international issues. He directs the PIPA Knowledge Network's poll, which, as you may know, conducts ongoing surveys in the U.S. public, plays a central role in the BBC World Service poll on global opinion, and he's now directing a major study of social support and anti-American terrorism in Islamic countries. He's in the middle of a number of significant looks at public opinions across the world right now, and we're very delighted, Stephen, that you could join us this morning. So the game plan here is that we'll have Stephen make some comments. We'll open things up to discussion. A little bit of a wild card is when our other speaker manages to pierce the 66 barrier. But we'll play that a little bit by ear. But I know that Stephen will launch us very well in this area. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Now, I need to clarify right from the beginning that I'm not a demographer. I study public opinion, and I look at demographic breakouts. And given the subject, you might and impressions that we might have of what's going on in the Middle East, you might assume that I'm going to tell you that young people are, you know, significantly different from their elders, that they're more anti-American, more anti-Westerners, and so on. But that's not true. They're not significantly different on very many questions. In fact, in some questions, they're slightly more positive about the United States and the West. They are probably more influenced by Western media. But it's also true that this young people in the Middle East are more susceptible to jihadist thinking, and so as a generation, they are of particular interest. The size of this generation is also very important. They, just like the baby boom generation in the U.S., they form a kind of center of gravity. And so whatever process they're going through tends to be play a central role in the culture, just like whatever the baby boom generation was going through had a pretty significant impact on the general culture. And I think that there are a lot of indications that this generation is having a particularly uniquely stressful time coming of age, so to say. Their parents came of age during the Cold War, and during the Cold War there was this kind of...
Hi there.
Yes. Welcome. Relieved to see you. I thought it was going to be all up to me for a while there.
This is a dramatic arrival.
Their parents came of age during the Cold War, and the polarity of the Cold War gave the Islamic world some kind of room to maneuver, to find a kind of unique position. But with the demise of the socialism, this has meant the rise of the Western model, or what I'll generally call the liberal model. And there's a lot that that people in the Islamic world, including young people, like about the Western model. But it's also a model within which they come up short on a lot of fronts. One of them is economic development. But also in terms of the values of democracy and personal liberties, these have not been as fully realized, and there is a kind of tension and clash with certain aspects of traditional Islam. So you could say that within this liberal framework, the Muslims are not really winners. There is not as much a basis for pride, for a sense of identity in a global context. Now, again, these feelings are present in Muslims as a whole, but I think are more salient or intensely felt among young people as they are going through this process of trying to define their identity. Okay, so what's the challenge? On one hand, there is this liberal system, and much of what is appealing about Al-Qaeda isn't necessarily the entirety of their framework, but rather that they are a way to stand up to the West, a way of affirming identity. I'm going to tell you a story of a focus group that I did. It happened to be in Indonesia, but I think you'll see that it's the same basic pattern. I was saying, well, what do you think Al-Qaeda is about? What are they trying to do? They're standing up to America. Okay, what else? They're saying that we're important. They're saying that we matter. What else? that. Okay. And that was just kind of ran out, and they kept saying that, basically. And I said, well, what do you think about the whole idea of reunifying the Ummah, creating an Islamic states and new caliphate and so on? And then there was a, Oh, yeah, that's right. They do say that, don't they? Yeah. Oh, we don't want that. But it didn't necessarily mean that they were pulling away from it. Now, also, there was a poll done by the Sadat Center that asked, when you think about Al-Qaeda, what aspect of the organization, if any, do you sympathize with most? And by far the largest, what was endorsed by 39%, was confronts the U.S. The idea of seeking to create an Islamic state was only mentioned by 6%. Or stands for Muslim causes such as the Palestinian issue even was quite low at 19%. And that was across Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Kuwait, Morocco, and the United Arab Emirates. It's also, what's really key is that the what we don't see is a rejection of American values, but of American policies. And again, as Cheripol asked, would you say that your attitudes toward the U.S. are based mostly on American values or American policy in the Middle East? And 82% said U.S. policies, only 10% said values, which in a way is a, you know, kind of a positive sign because it suggests that there's some potential for common ground. Again, those were Jordan, Morocco, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt. So it's these tensions are not necessarily intrinsic to U.S. relations. It's important to know, too, that in the 90s, these feelings were not as strong. In the 90s, USIA found 52% of Turks and 77% of Moroccans saying that they had a favorable view of the U.S. Now, on all of these numbers have gone down. I'm not going to. I assume that you've heard these numbers, plummeting numbers in terms of favorability ratings for the U.S. It's not that they were extraordinarily high in the Middle East, but they were much higher than they were before, and they have come down. And there's not a single country now that has a positive attitude toward the U.S. Unless you count Afghanistan. Where there is still now, and maybe even more so now, positive feeling toward the U.S. And in Saudi Arabia, it's not so bad. It's more divided. In a poll we did for BBC, it was actually divided that the U.S. is between 38% U.S. having a positive influence, 38% having a negative influence. But basically, all other measures find a pretty negative attitude. But what's key is that they can go up and down. It's not intrinsic to the relation to the U.S. And that what I'm going to suggest, and I'm going to show some data to support it, is that they actually endorse much of what we might call the liberal system or the liberal internationalist system, the system that was established in the post-war period that emphasizes international law, multilateral institutions, the illegitimacy of military force except in self-defense, the basis of state legitimacy being the consent of the governed, democratic process, human rights, the kinds that are expressed in the UN Declaration, and so on. And Al-Qaeda poses a challenge to that framework. Al-Qaeda specifically says that democracy is fetishizing the human, that it specifically rejects the United Nations and actually rejects another key aspect of a liberal order, which is a high level of interchange between the Muslim world and the outer world. Polls have showed that there is actually rather strong support for the whole idea of the separation of church and state. 54% said that the clergy should not dictate the political system. This view is a bit higher among young people. Only 30% say that the clergy should play a greater role in the political system. Again, that was across five or six Middle Eastern states. 66% even more so among young people, say that the government should make decisions based on what is best for the country. Only 17% said that they should make decisions based on what is best for Muslims. Democracy is actually gets very high grades in the Middle East, higher than in Western liberal democracies. Maybe because when you have experience with it, you see that its problems. But it is in principle widely endorsed. And the criticism of the U.S. is not because of the values that it promotes. In fact, the criticism that you most often hear is that it does not live up to them, that it is hypocritical. And it's interesting that even bin Laden, when he is criticized the U.S., for example, in the support for the regime in Saudi Arabia, has emphasized that regime is not representative, that it is not popular. It draws on the principle of representation as a basis for legitimacy when it criticizes the United States. So if it's not a value issue, it's a policy issue. What are the policy issues that are particularly offensive to Muslims? And here I would really emphasize that the essence of it is the question of pride. It's the question of identity. Asked what policies are seen as most important in the context of their dissatisfaction with U.S. policies, highest on the list is policy toward the Palestinians. Now, it's not really that people in that part of the world feel so strongly about the Palestinians per se. Remember, the Palestinians have not been all that well treated in that part of the world either. They have become a kind of symbol of the Muslim world and the extent to which the United States does not treat them fairly. That the U.S. favors Israel, the complaint is rooted in the idea that the U.S. presents itself as an honest broker, presents itself as trying to follow principles rather than narrow interests or proclivities, and yet the U.S. is perceived as plain favorites, that Muslims are treated as second class. Another key element is the U.S. military presence in the region. And what's really important here is the question of whether this is being done in a way that's responsive to the people's will. We just did a poll in Iraq that came out, and in Iraq, 77% think that the U.S. plans permanent bases in Iraq. And 78% say that if the Iraqi government asked them to leave, they would not leave. That is very powerful. And we also found that 61% approve of attacks on U.S. forces there. Rather sobering number. We looked at the relationship between this belief that the U.S. Plans permanent bases and support for attacks, and found that among those who believe that the U.S. plans permanent bases, 68% approve of attacks. Among those who think that the U.S. is not planning permanent bases, only 34% approve of attacks. So it's the concern. We also found that you don't have a majority who want the U.S. to leave right away, but many of those who support the attacks, only half of those who support the attacks say that they want the U.S. to leave right away. So what's going on here? It appears that the support for the attacks is derived from a concern that the U.S. will never leave, and that they need to put that pressure on the U.S. starting now and make it continuous. Again, what is key is the sense that their national sovereignty is being undermined. The perception in another question, overwhelming majority said that the presence of U.S. troops weakens the government. It basically undermines the strength of the government. So again, the problem is one of pride. The problem is one of identity, and this is intensified among young people. Whenever the U.S. does something that is offensive to Muslim pride throughout the world, people feel it throughout the region. Another example is Iran. Iran is not popular in the Middle East. Ahmadinejad is gaining some currency, but Iran is not. And interestingly, most believe in the region believe that Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons, and it concerns them. But they don't support treating Iran in a confrontational manner. They don't support sanctions. They don't support the use of military force and so on. When the U.S. uses the term like excess of evil and so on, this creates a negative reaction. They resist. They will resist those efforts even if they perceive it to some extent as being not, even if it's inconsistent with their self-interest, as in the case right now with Iran and then the nuclear weapons. In a way, you can say, look at this, that when the U.S. says you're either with us or against us, the reaction is, okay, well, then we're against you. And then there's a pulling toward anything that the U.S. is against. So what's just coming back to the question of the youth bulge? It's what's significant again is not that their attitudes are different, but that they are more intensified. They are at that stage of development, and it is likely that this will continue for some time to be the center of gravity in the culture. And up till now, the U.S. policy has been primarily oriented to looking at the older ruling elites and their interests, and U.S. policy has been oriented to, okay, how can we work with those interests and align ourselves with them and coordinate with them and so on. Not so much in terms of those identity concerns in that larger group in the culture, and that is becoming a problem for U.S. foreign policy.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cole. Now we'll shift from current attitudes to the underlying population trends. And
can I stand a quick myself?
Sure.
Whatever you want to do.
I prefer to do my own standing and clicking. How long? About 10 minutes.
John Alterman, yes, is director and senior fellow of the CSIS Middle East Studies program. Before joining CSIS, he was a member of the policy planning staff at the Department of State and a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. Prior to that, he was a scholar at USIP and at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And prior to that, he had a distinguished academic career as well. We are so relieved that you were able to penetrate the Washington traffic. And,
but now everybody knows I can't keep a job, and probably since I arrived, you kind of have an idea why.
Do you want me to get out of the way?
Sure. All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to actually make it here. What I want to talk about is sort of how to think about the demographics in the Middle East. A lot of the way people talk about it is they keep telling me how many kids are below 18, below 14. I think that's kind of the wrong way to think about it, because the real problems, the real challenges we're looking at are really for a slightly older demographic, and I want to walk you through some of that. We're going to talk about this youth glut, and we're going to give it a shape. I'm not going to talk about aging retirement. We'll talk about labor flows and the policy implications and then come to some conclusions. There are an awful lot of young people in the Middle East, and I think the best way to contrast it is to compare it to Japan. Now, Japan doesn't immediately interact with the Middle East, but Japan's population shape and the way its population shape is growing is symptomatic of lots and lots of countries around the world, not very much of the United States, but countries like Italy, Germany, Russia, and so on. And this is Japan's population. You have that sort of normal triangle, but look what's happening. It's turning pear-shaped in middle age, and then it's going, look where it's going to be in 2050. It's the opposite of where it started. Suddenly you have lots more older people, very few younger people in the system. What do we know about older people in the system? They're done working. They're dependents forever. Right? Their health care costs go up, and that's where that population is going. The number of people, the dependents on the lower end who are educating is small. And these are people in the workforce, and you see that triangle is all lopsided. The number of people who have retired over here is getting bigger and bigger, requiring support from a narrower base of people here. That's what's happening around the world. It's what's happening not only in Japan, it's happening in Italy, Russia, Germany, France, and so on. So let's look at Saudi Arabia, which is the opposite of this. Saudi Arabia starts off with a normal nice triangle. And look, it's a triangle. It's still that pyramid. And then we start to move. And that's Saudi Arabia in 2050. It's only starting to get that pear shape. That's amazing that you don't have it. Remember, Japan was like way over there in 2050. And Saudi Arabia still has a relatively young population. But look at this shape really carefully. Because what's the interesting part of the shape? The interesting part of the shape is right here. Right? That's the really interesting... That actually can be an advantage for Saudi Arabia because you've got more people working in working age than you have either younger people getting educated or older people in retirement. So it's kind of an opportunity, but let's think about that group for just a minute. This is another way to look at it, and the sort of interesting thing is your youth population, that's at the 15 to 30-year-olds, are staying relatively steady, right? They're not going down in either Saudi Arabia or Egypt. It's the kids under 15 that's going down. So if you think about it, and here's another graphic representation of it, the youth population, the 15 to 30-year-olds in Egypt, Palestine, Jordan, are all staying in this band between 25 and 30% of the population, whereas in countries like Italy, it's going down. And even in the United States, it flips up and then it goes down again at about 20%. It's kind of remarkable that these countries consistently, for some time to come, for the next half century, as we saw in the other thing, are going to have a disproportionate percentage of the population between 15 and 30. Well, what happens to that population? A lot of time they're unemployed. Right? The youth unemployment rate is double the overall rate of population in country after country after country. 70-90% of first-time job seekers are unemployed. They're sitting around for years waiting for their first job. People are leaving school after high school because why stay in school? There are no jobs. And then they don't have jobs because they're just out of high school, they don't have any skills. And they sit around for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years. Right? If you think about what do? We sort of know that 15 to 30-year-olds are trouble, and I know that 15 to 30-year-olds in the room can empathize with this. So what do? We put you guys in school, right? And you get in relationships and you get jobs, and that's how to make you behave. And I don't want to know what happens after happy hours. I really don't. But here's the thing. So that's what we do. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, there are no jobs. Can't get married. No reason to stay in school. So what happens to this population? I mean, they've got all that energy, all that frustration. I mean, some of the things Steve was talking about. But no sort of regulating institutions to get them settled down. And that's this incredible frustration. Oftentimes, they don't have marketable skills. There are twice as many new workers as there are jobs created every year in the Middle East. And that's not changing. When the Arab Human Development Report people did a survey of young people, they said, how many of you want to emigrate? A majority said they wanted to emigrate. Now, that's an elite. It's not necessarily representative, but it tells you something that if the cream of the society wants to get the heck out, something's going wrong. So you've got a lot of young people, and what does that mean? I think economically it means you have people who are dependents because they can't get jobs. They say, why should I stay in school? Because there's no reward for skills. And because you have this glut of young people, it suppresses wages. Right? Socially, what does it mean? It means you have too many people with way too much free time. People get frustrated. And here's the weird thing. Males can't get married. This is a strange graph. It's really hard to come up with this data. But the age of first marriage in the Middle East for males is shooting up. That's one of these socially restricting institutions that gets you to behave. I got to show up to work because I got to keep the jobs. I got to support my family. I'm in a relationship so I feel like I'm somebody. I have status in the community because I have a wife and kids. Or I'm just some unemployed schlump who can't get a job. And I'm angry at everybody about it. And look at what's happening. And, or you have the other thing you have is you have people who say, I will work in miserable conditions for 10 years in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or the United Arab Emirates or somewhere else so I can desperately get money to get jobs. So you have these large male migrant worker populations getting radicalized because they're treated like garbage, making low wages in places where sometimes the clerics are radicalizing. That's one of the things going on. And it's one of the consequences of this youth glut in the region. So let's talk about labor flows, because labor flows are interesting. You have Europe, which has an aging population, and you have the Middle East with a surplus population. So the obvious thing is that you take Middle Eastern labor and you have the young people going up and they can support all the retirees, all the pensioners in Europe. That works nicely in theory. Eastern Europe can't meet the labor demands of Western Europe because, in fact, Eastern Europe is aging faster than Western Europe is. So you have some people migrating for better jobs, but in general, Europe has this incredible need for labor. You could see the possibility of millions of people coming up from the Middle East. Except you tell Europeans that the solution to your problems is millions of people coming from the Middle East, and they say, I think I like my problems. Because if you look at what happened in Madrid and in London and other places, they say, we can't incorporate these larger populations. We already have a problem. I mean, the U.S. attitude toward Homeland Security is largely a borders issue. Europe can't do a border issue anymore, and they're not going to make it worse. You know, the brilliant Spanish solution to too many Moroccan migrants is to crack down the Moroccans and import Latin Americans to do menial jobs in Spain. Because it's at least the Latin Americans aren't blowing stuff up. But that creates a problem then for Moroccans who need jobs because there aren't enough jobs in Morocco. So all this stuff gets confused. The whole issue of European identity gets confused. And there's really a problem to educate and acculturate millions of young people. As we know, there's this ethnic underclass in city after city after city in Europe. Immigrants' links to homelands are sort of weird because you can be connected to your homeland while you're in Europe. You can watch satellite television. You can chat using voice over IP technology, very cheap phone calls. I mean, people are connected in a way that wasn't even possible 10 years ago. Conflicts get imported from overseas into Europe as a consequence of this labor migration. I mean, all these problems are problems that Europe is going to have to deal with. Europe will either have to deal with the labor side of the problem or the imported labor side of the problem. And I don't think they have a really good idea. The Arab governments don't have a really good idea other than exporting a lot of the labor, especially from North Africa. So you also have this problem of brain drain. Right? How do you keep really good people? If the systems don't work really well, how do you keep good people here? I was in Libya in January, and one of the problems they have is all the Libyan physicians, they train them and they get the heck out. Because why would you want to be a doctor in Libya? Make $300 a month, bad facilities, bad management, why would you stay? Go to Europe, even if you're working at a bad hospital in England, you're doing better than you would be in Libya. The Arab Interparliamentary Union did some estimates, 54% of doctors, 26% of engineers get out of the country. So not only are the countries investing in training people, but half the people they train, a quarter of the people they train, they have to overtrain to compensate for people who leave, and it's the best people who leave. Creates another deep problem inside the region. As I said, the Arab Interparliamentary Union said more than 50% of Arab and African students who study abroad never come back. So what does this all mean? Partly, the governments have to seize opportunities and train people. for decent jobs, they have to attract investment because ultimately they have to provide employment in their own countries. I don't think Europe is going to be a fix-all solution for their problems. They have to get migrants to return. The way they do that is by creating an attractive environment. It's pretty obvious. They have to improve the political and economic climate because they have to make it an attractive place where people feel they have opportunities. People feel like there's an even playing field or level playing field where they can profit. And I think there's this small window of opportunity because if they fall behind on the youth bulge, I think it's going to be very, very hard to climb back. For Europe's got to figure out their retirement boom problem now. They have to invest, and one of the things that they were trying to do with the Barcelona process was to try to invest European capital in the Middle East, keep Middle Eastern jobs there, and feed Europe. But Europe's got to straighten out this problem. They have to develop workers of the future. They have to figure out what labor is going to look like in the future. I think they have to invest in more education and exchange. And they have to continue their transition to a world in which it's harder to define what a European looks like, what a European is, what language or languages a European speaks, because it's not all going to look like it used to 50 years ago. For us, we're going to have an increasing set of challenges. Most of the danger, it seems to me, is political and military rather than social or economic. Immigrants or young Arabs are not going to overwhelm this country. We're too big. We have too young a population anyway. But I think that these demographic challenges that I've described are going to challenge allies throughout the world, both in the Middle East and in Western Europe. And we have to help our allies work through this problem. We have, I didn't go through the slides on what our demographics are, but we're actually much better situated than most countries in Western Europe. But that doesn't mean that we don't have interest in helping them get over the problems. We have to work with Europeans and Arabs on the future challenges, because these are really fundamental challenges, both for our Arab allies and for our European allies as well. The other thing is, even for our Arab enemies, that doesn't mean that the enemies are going to fall and they're going to be replaced by people who like us. I mean, in many cases, I think some of Steve's data suggests this, that even in countries that are hostile to the U.S., in many places where the governments are most hostile to the U.S., the populations aren't. But as they become more radicalized, they may become more so. So I think there's sort of no easy way out of these things. It's going to take a lot of time, a lot of investment, and ultimately, most importantly, a lot of education to provide opportunities that are going to allow people to prosper. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Well, I think a number of important comments have been made, and I think probably the best way to go now is to open things up to discussion. I had one of the lunch things by my bed. I think we've got limited time, and we want to be responsive to you, so why don't we'll begin kind of a clockwise tour, beginning with you, please.
Thanks very much. I have a question for Steve about the sample of your polling. Is it according along the Shia-Sunni divide? Because I think it would make a little bit difference. And another thing is, when you talked about the a negative attitude toward the Americans, and you mentioned two things, and I agree that the policies mainly, but probably one of the things that people don't talk about is the American alliance with dictators, as well against the wish of the people, and this has actually created a lot of anti-American sentiments in the region. I mean, did you test this as well?
I think well, just to speak to the last point, yes, that the support for perceived illegitimate governments is a key source of negative feeling toward the U.S. and is connected to the perception that the U.S. doesn't live up to the values that it promotes to others, which leads to this charge of hypocrisy, which is on the tip of it. And when you do focus groups in the region, it's just on the tip of everybody's tongue. I mean, it's really a theme. As far as the Sunni-Shia divide, it's not all polls are broken out that way. We've broken it out in Iraq, but there's no neither are particularly positive toward the U.S. We can say that much. Within Iraq, the Kurds are more positive, but there's no kind of core cluster anywhere that
as far as we can determine, that is fundamentally positive.
Yeah, this is also for Steve, just following up. So what countries are there that have the most problems in terms of their population thinking that the illegitimacy problem, and what other institutions are there that both have show up as a negative and as a positive, for instance, oil companies and things like that?
Remember we have limited data, I don't remember seeing specific questions about oil companies, but one thing that does very much stand out is that the perception is that the U.S. Involvement in the region is claims to be related to promoting democracy and so on, but in fact the key perception is that it's motivated by a desire for oil to create a footprint in the region, and so oil companies are clearly associated with that, and that's perceived in a negative light. Not per se the desire for oil, but that it's coupled with a way of coming into the environment that is not responsive to the broader needs, but to the needs of the U.S. entirely. This shows up in a lot of poll questions and in the focus groups. I don't know if I answered. You may have had another earlier question that I didn't fully answer.
What other institutions are there that show up as either strongly positive or strongly negative?
The United Nations, the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, those do better. Basically, multilateral institutions are better, and the European Union is better. So it's not than the United States. We do have data on all those points.
Can I just add, which I think goes to your point and goes to Steve's point about hypocrisy. One of the things that you actually hear a lot about in sort of Salafi and radical discourse is people keep talking about bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And say, what is this American fixation with not killing civilians? Because look at how many civilians they killed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I think they see this as a sign of our stunning hypocrisy, that when it suited our interests, we killed civilians, we bombed Dresden, and when they kill civilians, we act like it's not fair. You can have a discussion with people about this, but I think the perception that they have is oftentimes that we make rules that are convenient for us. And these are discussions that we simply don't have anymore. I mean, when's the last time anybody here in this room had a discussion about was it moral to drop the atomic bomb in Japan? We simply don't have that discussion. They have it all the time, every single day. And say, what does that tell us about the United States?
Yeah, I think that any effort that we would make to try to delegitimate the killing of civilians and thus delegitimate terrorism of any form would inevitably raise that question about whether states should also be constrained from using military force against civilians.
Please.
What about comparisons with other regions of the world in terms of the youth factor, where also there is the lack of economic development, high unemployment, heavy immigration of the elites, etc.? And how is that reflected in attitudes? Or is there something distinctive about the Middle East region in that regard?
Demographically, the other region that's sort of similar is Africa. In many cases, Africa is even poorer. It's harder for Africans to move around. Africans are less integrated. I think Africans also have a different history. Steve is absolutely right that there's a way in which the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is sort of seen as a prism through which people examine their own victimhood. It validates the sense that they can't get a fair shake. It validates their feeling of injustice in the world and helps to focus it. And quite frankly, the fact that there are some wealthy states in the region that support that discourse embeds it even further. You can, I don't know if you have any ideas about African attitudes.
Africa is one of the regions in the world that are most positive toward the United States. And including American economic involvement, they would like greater economic involvement by the United States, and they actually have a fairly positive attitude about the behavior of corporations there, in addition to support for aid activities. They don't feel that they're being fundamentally exploited. They don't perceive that the U.S. is using it for other political interests.
As a point of information here, the latest data from the U.S. Census Bureau suggests that the Middle East is the fastest growing region in the world, after which comes Sub-Saharan Africa. But the percentage of total population is relatively modest. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think it was about 2.5% 1950s, year 2000 about 5%, en route to about 7.5% of world total by the year 2050, according to UN projections.
Eric, only you are responsible for knowing the world total number. I just know the Middle East, North Africa number.
Fair enough.
It's about 400 million.
So, but just to put those points in broader context, please.
The further you go back in time, the thinner it gets as far as available polling data. What I can tell you is that before 2000, things were better. But I can't really. The further you get back into the mists of the past, it gets fuzzier.
Other questions, please? Comments?
I mean, the other point about this is that technology has made the United States a much more immediate concern for people. That in a time when you can watch satellite television images, in a time when people watch more videos and you get exposed, that people actually have an opinion about the United States. Whereas 20 years ago, populations were more illiterate. They didn't have video cassettes. They didn't have satellite television. People wouldn't really form an opinion. Now, the Palestinian Intifada was broadcast daily into people's living rooms. The war in Iraq was broadcast daily into people's living rooms. And that creates an opinion. And in many cases, people feel they have a more informed opinion than they do. But there's a feeling of immediacy, which even in the very recent past, you wouldn't have had. And it becomes something that I think, especially for non-Arab populations, populations in Southeast Asia and Africa and other places, Muslim populations, it becomes a sort of link to these conflicts and broadens people who feel personal involvement in the conflict because of media and technology.
And it's not necessarily either positive or negative. It's both. The images that they see of the West can be both attractive and upsetting, and generate all kinds of conflict within people and between people and between generations. And again, the younger people are drawn to a lot of things that they see through the media, as well as the generating conflict.
Please.
Question for John. If you could just it seems to me that the result you have for the 15 to 30 year olds is that it basically is going to stay at about the same high level. Is that
right? As a percentage of the population, you're going to have a large cohort in that 15 to 30 age group.
Okay, and then what has it done previous in history? Is there is the size, how much does the size matter instead of just the percentage? And then what has been happening to crime rates? Because linking, the only thing I know about demography in the West is that the people under 25 commit all the crimes. And so is that a phenomenon that's also
happening? You graduate to white collar crimes later on.
Yeah, but there are fewer of them, right? Because you got to be right up.
That's right.
But so what has been happening to crime, and is that an important dynamic? Thinking about how things are going to evolve.
Yeah, there's not a huge amount of crime in most Middle Eastern countries. There's not a lot of violent crime in a lot of these countries. If you look historically, there are demographers who understand things far better than I do who point to demographic instigators for World War I and, you know, obviously for the 1960s and the counterculture revolution. Russian Revolution, people say, may have been influenced by demography. They talk about these youth cohorts being responsible for change. That's an argument demographers have, and the last thing they want is some nerdy regional specialist like me poking in. But that's an argument that people that some people make and some people refute. I say these generally aren't societies with lots of crime, not a lot of violent crime, but the level of frustration is really there. And I think one of the really interesting things that you can see if you look, and I think most people in the United States aren't looking for it, this ties into some of what Stephen was saying. There's a sort of rise in what I would call aspirational culture. Game shows and reality TV in the Arab world, that helps people imagine better lives for themselves, which I think they tie into, and helps build an Arab identity that's really a real Arab identity that people relate to as people. The most popular show in the Arab world for many years running wasn't the opposite direction, the very popular Al Jazeera Shout Fest that was like Crossfire. It was the Arab version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Produced in London, went out to 22 Arab countries. And if you think about how that works, right? The reason game shows work is because you keep kicking yourself saying, I should know the answer, right? And it wouldn't work if it were a Lebanese game show. It wouldn't have a 22-country audience. And it wouldn't work if it were a Yemeni game show, and it wouldn't work if it were a Saudi game show. I mean, you have to create an Arab identity, a notion of what an Arab should know. I mean, one time I was in a hotel room in London. I was watching The Weakest Link. So I thought, you know, it's getting popular here. I thought, wow, I'll see the original. I had no idea what the hell they were talking about. Because game shows are incredibly culturally specific. And they were sort of talking about this thing and that thing and what's this. I have no idea. Never heard the words before. And for you to have an incredibly popular game show that asks people trivia about themselves as Arabs, that creates an identity, and it creates an aspirational identity, both an aspiration to having that common identity and an aspiration to the common culture and everything else, which I think is a huge driver in a lot of what we're seeing, not only the sort of question about what the relationship to the West is, but also questions about what these societies should be, need to be. We haven't explored, interestingly, some of the most creative people exploring are people in advertising who are trying to figure out ways to reach broad audiences. And one of the ways they do it is by putting forward this picture of intergenerational dialogue of people who can go overseas and still relate to people back home, of something that preserves culture and values but is still modern. I mean, if you look at advertising in the Arab world, it's becoming really, really, really interesting. And I think if you look carefully enough, you start to see interesting strands of how people's heads work, how societies work, and the kinds of futures people want for themselves. Some people certainly have very negative views, very dark, they've given up, and they're angry. But I think there are abundant signs of people looking for something much more positive, much more constructive, and ultimately that's much more in coexistence with Western countries rather than in opposition.
Just to build on that, Shibli Telhami has done quite a lot of work looking at the relationship between pan-Arab media outlets, so like Al Jazeera, and so how much people watch those and the effect on their identity as Arabs as opposed to national identity. And as Arab identity becomes stronger, Muslim identity becomes stronger, the narrative of Arabs or Muslims in the world becomes more salient. And that in the context that I was talking about before of the development of the global economy and so on, that's a narrative that is not an entirely satisfying narrative. And so that stimulates a greater sense of frustration. And that frustration, as John was saying, doesn't seem to be channeled into crime as much as it tends to be externalized outside, and particularly at the United States.
And just one last sentence, which I will tantalize you with. The big debate of the next decade in the Arab world is going to be a debate about authenticity, what it is to be authentically Arab. Do you have to be Muslim? Do you have to be anti-Western, anti-American? What kind of Muslim do you have to be? It's all going to be about authenticity in this very complex media environment. Other questions?
I mean, just in terms of the what... I mean, it's a kind of strange challenge for the U.S. and the West to say, okay, these people are living in a narrative structure within which they're not doing well. What do we do about that? Is there anything that can be done about that? I mean, we could have a bigger discussion, but I think in a way that is the central problem, to not think in terms of what are the interests there that we can work with, but what are the stories that they're working.
Great book, Stephen Humphrey's Between Memory and Desire, The Middle East in a Troubled Age. Great title, great book. Other comments, questions? Well, let me end with one kind of wrap-up question, if I may. It's clear that we have a number of different national approaches across the region to dealing, with the one hand, and shaping perceptions of upcoming generations, and also the dealing with the challenge of integrating those generations into society, politically, economically, socially. How do you compare the contrasting strategies across these countries? What is the mosaic that we have in place right now, and which of the strategies are working and which are failing? It's a big question, I know.
I honestly don't think that
there are really national strategies. I think that there's so much lumpiness. I mean, governments are all trying to change education in some way or another. Some places it's going to be easier, some places it's going to be harder. But there's just so much diversity in approach within countries, creating private education, creating parallel education systems, training, job creation, changing the investment market, everything else, that it just seems to me that the real headline sort of 20 years from now is going to be that Arab identity will actually mean something for the first time. I mean, really mean something for the first time ever. And that people will move back and forth in a more modular way, that there will be something less Jordanian about Jordanians. And there will be a huge variety of Jordanian experiences. Many Jordanians will have more in common with Saudis than they have with other Jordanians, and vice versa.
I guess I would choose Tunisia as a case example of one that seems to be doing relatively well, and probably what's key there is that they have found a way to be more open economically, to engage the global economy more, and that has created a certain sense of success and a certain sense of pride, and in the sense then to presents a kind of model.
And the interesting factoid on Tunisia is when I was there a year ago, somebody who had studied Arabic there a decade ago said when he came back, there were words that people always used to say in French that now people said in Arabic. Mm. That there's a process of Arabization going on in Tunisia. That Tunisia had always felt that it had a unique relationship to the West or a unique relationship to France. And what has been happening in Tunisia is Tunisia has been integrating more and more into an Arab world where they're more and more like their neighbors.
Another example really is Morocco, and I think the new king is modeling a unique and effective stance that is getting quite a positive response from the people there, and there are certainly resistances and so on, but he's sort of a kind of a wave of the future, a sense of pride, but also a sense of engagement with the larger world.
Well, our two speakers have succeeded here this morning. They've succeeded in raising a number of critical issues, highlighting a number of very significant uncertainties that we face longer range. They've raised a number of interesting and compelling points. So I'd like to ask you to join me in thanking them for their contributions. There's more to come. We'll be sending you communications about future forums of this nature. Stephen was telling me prior to beginning our session here this morning that there are a number of new and important surveys and broader survey efforts that will be hitting the headlines before too very long. One, if you'll permit me, involving Iran. Keep your eyes out for that. I'm sure it will yield some very interesting insight on these complicated issues.
Anybody who would like to be on our e-alert list to be notified of new polls that come out, we in the next few, probably later, hopefully later this month, we're going to get a major study out of a poll in that was done in Iran, or is being done in Iran as we speak.
So thank you very much for being with us this morning, and thank you, Route 66, for enabling
Indeed.
Our speaker, John Alterman, to be here so quickly.
And damn you, United Airlines.